So we never go over time, ever. So, thank you very much for inviting me, Derek, and also the other fellows. It's a privilege to be here. It's great to hear all these great talks so far. So very excited. So my talk, as far as this symposium, has to do with what I consider a missing part of what we've been thinking about when we think about machine learning. And it's that the machines themselves are actually their interactions among themselves. We may not know clearly. And also how we interact with them is a bit of a black box. So my contention in this talk is to actually show you what artistic practices can show us in regards to how humans interact with machines in the way that we're using the way that we perceive machines is the subject which machines can now use to interact with us. So just a brief introduction. I am at Parsons. I'm doing research also at Cornell Medical University for my PhD in UCLA. And that previously I actually did work in PTSD and dopamine, evaluating basically a very fundamental circuit in that neuroscience field. And then I today, though, I'll be talking about these particular projects that I'm involved in. My practice is very interdisciplinary, as you can see. The neuroscience stuff actually gets translated into work with VR and with social anxiety and helping people in that area. But actually, the stuff I'm very passionate about is the artistic practice and the user interaction and how to see how interaction is being done. And I think that the neuroscience actually helps me a lot in that regard as well. Okay, so first of all, I want to get some hands around the room. Can anybody describe what this picture is in one sentence? Anybody want to try to, you know, it doesn't have to be perfect. Want to take a stab? Yeah.
Heat lamp on a wooden robotic arm with a couple little speakers.
Great. Great. Yeah. And so, so physically we see this, right? And then the combination of what this looks like. The heat lamp, you notice, is kind of slouched like this. And, you know, these distance sensors look like they could be eyes, even though they're not. And looking at this, you probably have evoked some sort of humanoid emotion, right? Like they're doing something, their head might be down, might be shy, might be kind of flaky, right? And so my contention with this picture is actually that this combination of objects that we built here, actually by the way we assemble it, by the way humans put it together to do a certain purpose, actually gives you emotionality, actually gives something that connects with us, the human. And therefore, the hardcore machine learning doesn't even have to take place, right? So what do people usually do use machine learning to do in art? So there's some early work. For example, this is a computer that's mimicking an artist named Harold Cohen's drawing style and then reproducing paintings that are in his image but are not exactly his work, right? And then similarly, we have work with Google that kind of help people make sound and things like that. But what I contend, though, that machine learning in that sense still doesn't capture what humans and machines actually, their relationship actually is. It's more about helping us do things, right, artistically. So I like to give this example of machines with an order of mystery. So you imagine basically you're doing some ordering online and all of a sudden you're getting this chat window that pops open. You talk with it for a while and then you realize, wait, its English is not kind of its strong point, but somehow it knows like all your orders, like, you know, like randomly from way back even, and you know, like they can regurgitate dates all the time. So you think like maybe is this, well, usually you think it's like maybe somebody from the Philippines or, you know, like somebody who's like pressing some buttons and interacting with you. But at the end, you can't really tell whether it's actually a machine or a human, right? It could be someone chatting with you, or it could be a machine. And so what I like to think in this paradigm is actually it's the secret lives of the machines. The lives have their machines that now we can imagine, Okay. So, but our imagination is what you can now use, basically, in your artistic practice. So, early work that I did is, I built a chatbot, and you can see that when you're chatting with the chatbot, that sometimes the chatbot will just, like, not respond to you. Like, you know, so this is kind of a, it's built on top of this, psychotherapist, you know, chatbot thing. So you really want them to reply right there, like, are you okay? You know, like, et cetera. And when I tested with, people, they actually found that the number one thing is first of all, they say it's cute. Like, this is cool, this is cute. But the number two thing they say is actually like, wait, is the chatbot talking to someone else? Like, that's the biggest question, because they have their own secret identity that, you know, we don't know what's really going on. But of course, it's all programming. We just programmed it. This is the kind of work that I like to get to. So I will show you a brief video of one of the first things I did. So it's this lamp that's basically shy. So when you look at it, it kind of turns away. Otherwise, it's kind of tracking your face. So it's kind of cute. So I will show you the video. Here we go. This is real footage. It actually broke like that. So you notice the way that I present this as a narrative? It makes you think that this is like a living lamp that's been around, and you know, we salvaged it and built it and it broke down, right? So this is one of the things I really like to do in my practice, is to actually build a story for these things. And then immediately the human emotion gets involved. So starting with that, and then what I was thinking is actually, you know, this is kind of interesting and cute, but what about interaction with groups of machines? Like, this is one machine. But what about machines amongst themselves? So this is like a much less explored area, and it's more difficult to do. And so what I wanted to do was actually build a bunch of micro machines that actually interact with each other, and then add the human interaction on top of it. So what that will do is, so from here I'm using computer vision, you know, so basically a machine learned previously set of faces, basically. And then when they are able to detect your face, they would do one thing. And when they can't see your face, they would do something else. So that's kind of the core thesis of this. I also noticed that, like, we look at machines all the time. I'm looking at my machine right now. And then actually this is a photo of what the machine sees. Like, well, not me, but, you know, not her, but this is what machines like to see. And I noticed that, you know, what if the machines are actually, you know, looking at us, right? So these machines are all going to be looking in the same direction using computer vision. And one of the key things with this next project, actually, is that I decided to do two main types of interaction. So one is where the machine actually keeps track of where your face is. So I call it like the model-based system. It knows where your face is, and it keeps track of where your face is over time, you know, 3D. And then the other one is actually in sort of the area of reinforcement learning. It's called model-free learning. And in that one is the machine is just there. The camera is just looking in one direction. But when you are seen in the camera, then the machine sees you. So if it's not clear, I will explain it later a little bit more. But when you're not seeing, the machine won't see you. You have to get its attention to get it to see you. So you see that a little bit in the video. Hopefully, just wanted to see if you guys can pay attention to that part. That guy actually has a camera mounted on his head. So it can only see the close by stuff. And it's kind of a prima donna, right? It's not, I don't care. Like, you know, you have to go, oh, hey, me, I'm here, to get it to actually see you. There's another camera, though, is in the back, and that controls a different subset of machines, and those are based on calculations. So they know your face, where your face is at all time, and all those sets of cameras all just look at you when your face is facing back. Okay, I will also show the video so you get a sense of what's going on. So I went from 2001 A Space Odyssey to Romeo and Juliet. So they're playing with what when they can be seen, basically, your face. So they keep going closer until they detect the face, and then she lost because her face was the one detected. So this is when your face is seen. And then when your face is not seen, well, they do something different, let's just say. So I want to get back to a point that I made earlier about models. So it's not totally clear in the video, but so the camera that's controlling that model-based system is all the way in the back there. So it's able to see everybody. So basically it's calculating, it keeps track of all the angles that these machines have to be. And when your face moves, it'll just move all those machines to some specified angle. The model-free system is different. So it has a camera that's on it. It has sort of its own initiative. And those minions actually just follow them. So wherever this guy looked, they're just going to follow them. So it's that's why it's kind of model-free. And you can actually see different interactions when you have fun with the audience. With this one, people are like, oh, okay, it's cool, but, you know, I know what's going on. I know the guys are following me. When I turn away, they do their own thing. With this guy, people say like, oh, these are so flaky. Like, I can't get them to, you know, see my face. And I actually, this is where I kind of started. So my current exhibit at the New York Hall of Science actually uses this model because kids, they like to kind of play with this idea. They don't like the kind of everything just works perfectly. They like these kind of interactions where they're not sure, and sometimes maybe you don't even look at them, even when they are close. And so I find it really interesting to have these types of interaction. And this is a way, I think I'm still starting to explore it, but this is a way that we can start looking at how to have interactions among machines themselves and use that to your artistic advantage to show emotionality and capture the human projection of the emotion and take this out and show them that this is what you're emoting on. So, okay, so that's my core ideas. This is what, it's actually got some labels on it that also makes it interesting. So the rest of the talk, actually, I wanted to actually talk about a couple other things because I'm here and I heard a lot of really cool stuff about EEG, and so I wanted to kind of just give a sense of the kind of work that I was doing in that area. So I trying to translate transition that from machine networks to human networks. So how do people understand each other and how do people communicate each other? The setup for this is based on Moritz Wehrmann's alter ego, and so this kind of this idea of having the lights on both sides of the of a conversation is his. But I added the interactivity and the EEG work that I'll show you. Okay. So first of all, my idea is that so in psychology, there's always this idea that you know I'm a speaker and you're the listener, and I'm giving you information. That's like the classical information transmission idea. But what's really going on, I think, in the real understanding of it is actually the listener is providing attention. So the giver-receiver relationship is kind of flipped. You know, it's not that I'm giving you information. It's really that you're giving me a piece of your mind, a piece of your attention, so that my, you know, my spirit can actually live on, like, in your mind, you know? So this is the kind of idea I wanted to elaborate here, because if the one that's, the person who's talking is actually taking the attention away. And so this is a project basically about how people communicate narcissistically, and then when they talk, they really want to like show themselves off, right? Like I'm doing right now, you know? Okay, so I just kind of said this. We talk to really want to see ourselves. We want to see where the, whoa, I did all this work, you know? And then similarly, when we think about, you know, we want others to pay attention to ourselves. And so in the EEG measurements, I actually asked them to basically pay attention to that idea, like get other people to pay attention to you. Okay, so I'll tell you what the EEG part is in a second. So here's the setup, though, and very simple. So after Moritz, is that you have LED lights on both sides. And the first thing I did was actually just talking. When they're talking, whoever is talking, their light on that their side will light up. And when it lights up, basically, so when this side of the light lights up, you're going to see yourself. So when you talk, you're going to see yourself. And the other person also sees you, right? So, and then similarly, when this other light turns on, then the other person will see themselves. You're going to see them. So whoever talking gets the attention, basically, gets the image displayed, right? So you see the thing that you talk. Whoever's talking. And so in that image, you're basically saying the other person is actually talking. The other person to her is actually talking. And then I guess I should talk about this. So EEG comes in where in addition to the conversation being driven by the conversation driving the lights, I also said, well, what happens if we hook them up to EEG? So just use Bluetooth, get the OSC data in the computer, and then to compare their attention level. Whoever has the higher attention level has their light on. So it's like, pay attention to me, pay attention to me, pay attention to me. It's like, yeah, right? So, and so you will see that in the video. And I basically show, for those of you who are kind of into this stuff, I show the wavelet transform of the attention that you get back from Neuro Sky, basically. That's the headset I'm using. So, okay, so let me just show you a video. So that's the attention. So. So people kind of get addicted a little bit to this setup because it's totally dark. It's kind of hard to explain, but it's in this room where it's intoxicating because you see yourself or you see the other person. It's like boom, 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 boom. And then you're just like, oh, you know, you want to use your headset to its maximum advantage. Hopefully it says something about people's tendencies. What else can you do with EEG? I think I'm a little bit short. Yeah.
Do you think it says something about people's tendencies, or do you think that it's a construction that encourages narcissistic attitudes and behaviors? You know, much as the way that Survivor and all these reality shows encourage a view of human nature that's inherently domineering and competitive.
Yeah, I mean, I think this installation is not... You know, it's a material, so people can take away what they think of it.
But I don't think that the construction is neutral. I think it actually encourages narcissistic ways of thinking about people.
Well, when, in the talking part, they're not told to, you know, we filmed that script, obviously, but when
I mean,
we...
Would it be different if it lit up when the on the other person when the speaker is speaking?
Yeah, we can do that. We can do that. And actually, we did some trials where the lower attention span actually turned on the light as well. So there's, you know, there's things we can play. So, yeah, you're totally right that it depends on what message you want to kind of deliver and you want to tell the story. In this case, I think even with the people just naturally talking, they can get a sense that, oh, this is actually what's happening. Like, I'm seeing myself, you know, when I'm talking. So yeah, you're right. It's not, I don't know if it's encouraging either way, but you can definitely play with it to give different stories. Yeah. So what else can you do with EEG? Just a couple of other similar, you know, small things. So I actually did also a speculative design project. So I imagine that in the future, actually, EEG games, telewave games, is becoming kind of like the Olympics, you know, so. Mm-hmm. So we have things like balloon popping, so you use your attention to blow up balloons. You have things like, you know, acrobatic meditation is like you're doing all this acrobatic stuff, but you have to get your EEG signal low, like your alpha has to be high, I guess, right? So like, you know, some people are really good at that. Anyway, so came up with a couple of mental athletes in this world as well. So we have one who's KDK, his nickname, and he's, you know, he's like below. So basically for 1.5 hours of playing game, he can play games while basically he's asleep. Like his like way down. He's like, you know, kind of like the current StarCraft people, you know, et cetera. So, and then we have another mental athlete. So she's a little bit different. She's like, so there's a kind of, I imagine it as being, one is like the physical challenge. How do you maintain your waves or how do you do your waves? But the other one is kind of aesthetic. Like you could create all these amazing wave patterns that nobody's seen before. Like, you know, that kind of thing. And so she's one of the first people to give this whatever gamma, beta, delta, boom. Like, I don't know. Just made it up. But particular styles. So kind of aesthetic, kind of analogous to like figure skating and also like just brute force. Yeah. And then you can actually see this thing in action. So using kind of similar systems, but now building a device where these two guys are competing to see who can blow up the balloon. You see that they care very much about this proposition. And then Leah on the left won because her balloon blew up first. Okay. So that's just a short project about what you can do with EEG. And then the last thing I want to talk about is a little bit of wearable computation. So let's see, I have 5 more minutes. So this is a project that I haven't put online yet. Everything else is already online. So this is a very recent project, which I want to talk about because it's kind of in line with some of the early talks a little bit with the EEG sonification, things like that. So in this case, I'm not using EEG, but I am using human movements to drive live coding of music. So do you guys kind of know what live coding is? I'll just give you like a quick, I don't actually know if the sound is going to work, but what I'm using is actually Sonic Pi. Okay, looks like the sound is not working here, but basically what happens is I have this code that's sitting here that's generating the music, and then during the performance, I will go and change these parameters. So you'll get a sense of what the sound actually looks like in the video that I'll show you. And then what I want to do basically is use the OSC data that I'm getting from a Raspberry Pi that tells you where your movements are to actually change parameters. For example, the release or the cutoff, things like that. That's what live coding is. Okay. So, and then also we're doing, I'm also collaborating here with amazing fashion designer. So she and I came up with this design of this waving motion. So these are actually boiled wool that you actually like painstakingly hand stitch together. I had to do like a sleeve one time and I was like, oh my God, I'm not doing the whole garment. And so we're calling this creative flow. So kind of, you know, both the flow in the garment and also the movements that translate into music. Okay. So yeah, this is what the fabric looks like. We explored a few different things and this is the one. And just to show you, this is what the system looks like. So you're the garment and actually we have one Raspberry Pi and a bunch of different accelerometers. In different parts of the clothing. Different parts will actually tell you more information because here you're not getting as much data just from rotation, but when she goes like this, you're gonna see a lot. And then that will translate to OSC to Sonic Pi. Sonic Pi plays it audio on a Bluetooth speaker. And then, so this is kind of a non-traditional way of doing live coding, not just with code, but actually with movements. And actually you can imagine extending to things like EEG as well. Yeah. So this is where we decided to put the sensors. Okay, I'll show you the brief video and I think my time is up. It's one of the sensors and the battery that goes in. Yeah, and then just a quick demo on what the sensor is that I'm using. So just when you tilt a certain direction, over here, sorry. Okay. Cool. And that's it for now. And hopefully you guys take away a little bit about what I said about the Secret Labs machines, because they have their own lives. And it's really takes us talking to them and them listening to what we're feeling when they're doing something, that would be important, I think. Thank you.